Welcome back, our fellow patriots, to the Patriot Lessons American History and Civics podcast. Today, we return to our deep dive into the Declaration of Independence. We are in the middle of our review of the list of grievances against the king. If you missed our prior episodes, you might want to go back and catch up to where we are now. Plus, Mike Gerard is slowly but surely remastering our catalog, starting with our most recent episodes first. If the fancy strikes you, I think you will enjoy the remastered episodes. Otherwise, please join us right here and right now. I'm joined by Mike Gerard and bombastic Brent Bassett. Today we are exploring the following grievances from the Declaration of Independence. Quote, for depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury, for transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses, for abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government, and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule in these colonies. Unquote. In our last regular episode, we explored the 16th and 17th grievances that the colonists made against the king. They involve cutting off trade with all parts of the world and imposing taxes without our consent. As we have discussed in prior episodes, the 13th grievance is about Parliament pretending like it has the authority to legislate for the colonies. Following the grievance is a specific list of particular examples. The list of pretended legislation continues here as the 18th, 19th, and 20th grievances. Now, as an Oakland County Circuit Court judge, I have presided over more than 350 jury trials. So I will bat lead-up hitter today and take on the 18th grievance.
Hey Judge, before you begin, I want to remind everyone that the Patriot Week Foundation is hosting its 8th annual Patrick Henry Awards on March 23rd, 2021 via Zoom. This really will be a fantastic event. It's an inexpensive way to support our nonpartisan, nonprofit work. And we're going to be joined this year by ABC's Bob Woodruff, who is not only an amazing journalist and presenter, but he was also grievously injured as a war correspondent in Iraq. And the event's also going to include a brilliant reenactment of Patrick Henry's Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death speech, read by Patriot Week's co-creator, Leah Warren. There's also going to be a fabulous Abigail Adams reenactor, a tribute to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and we're going to hear from retired Brigadier General John Slocum, who, among other things, flew F-16s. Supersonic! You need to join us, and you can check out all the details at patriotweek.org. Okay, Judge, step up to the plate.
Thanks, Mike Gerard. Now on to the 18th grievance against the king. It is as follows, quote, for depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury, unquote. Let's face it, most people consider jury service to be nothing more than an irritating inconvenience, something to dread and avoid if at all possible. Well, I can vouch that for most people, that is definitely their attitude when they first appear in my jury box. But I begin my jury trials with a quick overview of the importance of the jury and our historical alternatives, and that tends to significantly improve people's eagerness to serve. When the case is over, I go and talk to them in the jury room, and they almost universally really enjoy it. Even cases that might seem really boring and tedious to judges and lawyers are just fascinating to juries, and they do a great job.
That's right, Judge. I think this might have been mentioned before, but one time I spent a week watching Judge Warren do his job. I was on his jury, and I loved it.
Bombastic Brent Bassett, that was an experience neither of us will forget. But we digress. Irrespective of your particular feeling about or experience with jury duty, the right to a jury trial is a fundamental right of Americans that has long, deep roots in British law. There has been a great deal of scholarship about the origins of the jury. Although there seems to be more than one source, the predominant one came with the Norman invasion of England. The Normans were originally Vikings. Yes, Vikings, who in the 900s were allowed to settle in the Duchy of Normandy in modern-day France. An Anglo-Saxon king in England, Edward the Confessor, died in 1066. His mother was a Norman. When Edward the Confessor died without an heir, machinations making Game of Thrones look simple were unleashed. Duke William of Normandy took the opportunity to assert a claim on the English throne and invaded England. Meanwhile, Edward the Confessor's brother-in-law, Harold Godwinson, took the throne. Putting aside more Game of Thrones intrigue, the important point is that at the Battle of Hastings, William defeated King Harold. Indeed, Harold was slain in the battle. Accounts differ if it was an arrow in the eye, an arrow in the head, or by a sword wound from William's own hand. In any event, the last successful invasion of England had been accomplished, and Duke William of Normandy became King William the Conqueror and ascended to the throne of England on Christmas Day 1066. Charles Rembar, a First Amendment lawyer and legal scholar, explains that with the invasion came a form of the jury.
We have a fair idea of where the jury comes from. It had more than a single source. This has contributed to the melee of scholarship. The main one seems to be the royal inquest that the Normans brought across the English Channel. They probably learned it from a practice of the Frankish kings, who themselves may have got the idea from some Roman or Teutonic antecedents. Wherever the Romans got it, it is known that they used it. The king would now and then direct a group of inhabitants to make a statement, a sworn statement, on some question that concerned him. The fact that they were made to take an oath gave the thing its name. Jurare means to swear. The king or his emissaries would ask the jurors whether crimes have been committed in the neighborhood, or how the king's subordinates were behaving, or which of two disputing claimants had the better right, or even whether certain land was owned directly by the king or only as a suzerain of another lord.
Now, the king likely did this to resolve low-level disputes without becoming embroiled in unnecessary controversies, be they be with the church or powerful nobles. It diffused resentment by dispersing the responsibility away from the king and toward neutral arbitrators. But why this particular method? After all, there were other ways to achieve these same ends. For example, divination, like oracles, the reading of the guts of animals, astrology, or channeling divine spirits through any assortment of rituals. It appears that the kings wanted to avoid dependence on, and perhaps controversies with, religious institutions. In any event, nearly 1,000 years ago, a form of the jury became rooted in English soil. William the Conqueror is also famous for taking a monumental survey of all the people, land, and property in England. He wanted an inventory of everything in England. You know, he wanted to know what he had just conquered, to get a lay of the land, and to know what his rights were. It was all put down in the Doomsday Book. Doom here only has one O, and doom means law or judgment, not doom with two O's like the end of times or the end of your life. They do both have the same root, but they eventually diverged in English. In any event, with the Doomsday Book came a need to resolve disputes, and the king appointed assistants who in essence acted as judges in proceedings called an inquest. Over a long and complicated process, William the Conqueror's successors began to appoint officials who presided over the resolution of disputes with something akin to a jury. This really started to take form under King Henry II, who ruled from 1154 to 1189. Henry II took power from a pretty rotten King Stephen, who left England in a shambles. To reassert authority and right the ship, King Henry II issued an order called the Assize of Novel Disseisin, which among other things created a primitive court system including juries. In the reigns of William the Conqueror and Henry I, juries had been used in selective circumstances such as disputes involving the king, nobility, military, or clergy, or if someone had enough money to pay for the honor. But King Henry II made it the standard for anyone, for just a small fee. Originally, this jury system was for civil disputes only, but Henry II extended it to criminal cases in 1166, exactly a century after the Battle of Hastings. But these juries all are the opposite of what we think of today. Today, juries need to be fair and impartial. which means that those who serve on a jury know nothing about the case until after they are chosen. If a person knows something about the case beforehand, he or she will be called as a witness. But under Henry II, the witnesses served as the jurors. Rembar explains.
It was not the jury as we know it. It was a body of neighbors who acted on their own knowledge of the facts, as did the juries of the Domesday Book. They did not sit and listen to the evidence. They brought the evidence to court themselves, inside their heads. The idea of proving a case in court came later, and later yet, the idea that to make the trial a fair one, the jurors should have no preconception of the verdict they will render. The very thing that then was looked for in a juror is now good reason to reject him. The ultimate function of the jury is the same, determination of the facts. But the present method is antipodal to what it was when the jury system started.
Before Henry II, crimes were addressed in ways that today we would consider irrational, bizarre, outlandish, and barbaric. First, there was no government prosecutor. Justice was fundamentally privately prosecuted and decided. Even in the case of a murder, it would take a relative of the victim to accuse someone else of the crime, or the crime would be ignored. One way of deciding guilt or innocence was the hue and cry. That basically meant a person would accuse someone of a crime, a crowd of neighbors would pour out and chase down the accused, and once the accused was caught, he would have to convince the crowd that he was innocent, or the crowd would lynch him. Another way of deciding justice was the compurgation, in which an accused would swear under oath that she was innocent. And then she would have to gather up a set of number of other similar oaths from other people, usually a dozen. If she did that, she walked free. Then there was the ordeal. That basically meant the accused was tested by some kind of painful test. An accused could be burned with a hot poker. If the injury healed one way, he was innocent, and another way, guilty. And then there was trial by combat. Yep, you heard that right. Give the accused and the accuser, or their champions, weapons and send them onto a field or an arena to fight. Whoever won was vindicated because God ensured that the just party would prevail during the trial by combat. You may remember from Game of Thrones that the Mountain and the Viper have a brutal battle by combat scene to determine the fate of Tyrion Lannister. That was no joke. King Henry II was a true humanitarian and rational. He tried to standardize the law for all of England and to replace at least some of these superstitious, cruel ways of determining guilt by jury trials. But Henry's system is a far cry from what we would consider the fair and impartial adjudication of justice. Jurors are all drawn from the Knights of the Realm. They don't hear witnesses. They can rely on hearsay, which is when a person repeats what he heard someone else say. To be brought to trial, a large set of jurors have to agree that there is enough information to bring the case forward. That is basically what we today would consider the equivalent of a grand jury. Then a smaller jury, what we would consider the equivalent of a petite jury, of usually 12 people in a criminal case, renders a verdict. But in Henry's system, trials continue via ordeal. But the compurgation is abolished in criminal cases. And even if you prevail in the ordeal, you are banished. So one way or another, it was the grand jury that decided your fate. And here is where some modicum of due process kicks in. Grand jurors interrogate locals about what happened. Originally, 12 knights are called together, and if they agree, the case goes to trial or not. If they cannot agree, more knights are added until at least 12 agree. If they agree on a trial, the king's judges come onto the scene, and they interrogate the grand jurors and those locals who already talked to the jurors. Everything must line up. Anyone found to be lying in this process will go to prison and forfeits all of his goods. Not too much later, in 1215, Pope Innocent III abandons ordeals and England follows suit. Within a handful of years, trial by a jury of a dozen men began to become entrenched. Still, the jurors rarely heard witnesses. Instead, the jury was composed of people who we would today consider to be the eyewitnesses or people who knew of the case because of hearsay and secondhand accounts. But over the generations and centuries, the process gradually changed and evolved into the one we have today. One key development was the trial of Quakers William Penn and William Meade. In a crackdown against religious dissenters, Parliament had passed the Conventicle Act of 1664. The act outlawed the gathering of five or more people over the age of 16, not of the same household, from worshiping God in a way not officially sanctioned by the Church of England. The penalty: heavy fines, imprisonment, forced labor, banishment. The gravity of the penalties increased for repeat offenders. Now, that act of 1664 was up for renewal in 1670, which sparked courageous opposition demonstrations. Quakers William Penn and William Meade had tried to attend a large worship service in violation of the act, but the authorities, having caught wind of the meeting, padlocked the premises. Penn was not to be deterred, and he began to address the locked-out crowd, and he and Meade were arrested within just a few minutes. But they were not charged with violating the Conventicle Act, but with a common law offense of addressing a tumultuous assembly. The trial was a farce. Four witnesses testified they saw Meade at the assembly, that Penn said words they could not recall, and that there were several hundred people there. Author, journalist, and lawyer Sadakrat Kanji gives an excellent accounting of what happened next.
When the defendants tried to address the jurors, contending that they had not incited violence and pleading with them to remember that verdicts would affect tens of thousands of lives, they were swiftly dragged into the holding cell. As Penn continued his speech from below the court, Judge Thomas Howell told the jurors that they had heard evidence proving the indictment and should now return their verdict. There is no doubt what he expected it to be.
Now, at this time in history, that judges would instruct the juries in such a fashion was not uncommon. I could never do that today, but back then, judges were expected to share their opinions and expertise with the jurors. By the way, there were three judges. Well, something funny happened on the way to the verdict. Kadri continues.
But events then took an unexpected turn. The jurors asked for time to consider their decision, a request that was itself becoming unusual by the late 17th century, and it was an hour and a half before they returned. Eight were ready to convict, but four of them, led by a wealthy Puritan sugar merchant named Edward Bushell, were not prepared to do so. Judge Samuel Stalling declared Bushell impudent, and the jurors were sent away to think again. By the time the jurors returned, Bushell had been elected foreman, and he now declared that Penn was guilty of speaking at Grace Church Street. Since speech alone had never been a crime under English law, the finding amounted to a verdict of not guilty.
But the drama was not over. After being sent to deliberate again, the jury again repeated the verdict of not guilty for Meade and guilty only of speaking for Penn. The judges sent them back and told them that they would not be free to leave until they reversed both verdicts. Overnight, the jurors were deprived of food, drink, fire, and even a chamber pot. The next morning, the jurors came back with the same verdict. Starling was enraged and snarled he would cut Foreman Bushell's throat if he ever got the chance. The jury was sent away and came back with the same verdict. Another night in the same conditions, and then the jury caved in. Instead of finding Penn guilty, they delivered a not guilty verdict for both defendants. The jurors were fined and jailed if they did not pay. Foreman Bushell and three others decided to go to jail. After 10 weeks in a terrible prison, Lord Chief Justice Vaughan let the jurors out. He declared that jurors could reasonably disagree. He reported,
"The verdict of a jury and evidence of a witness are very different things. A witness swears to what he hath heard or seen, but a jury, a man swears to what he can infer and conclude from the testimony of such witnesses by the act and force of his understanding."
The independence of a jury, and its rightful role as the arbiter of the facts in an impartial manner, had finally been tested and won. By the mid-1700s, criminal procedures evolved to be much more like the processes we expect today. These changes, along with the lore of the trial of William Penn, dramatically changed the view of the fundamental, indispensable importance of the jury. Cadre explains.
The jury was propelled into the moral stratosphere. The myth of justice that had been gripping England had found its institutional hero, a body of men so brave it would go to jail for the underdog, and so selfless it would forego its collective chamber pot for love of liberty. There would always be some controversialists prepared to point out that jurors slept on the job and hanged children as well. But the most influential legal writer of the 18th century, William Blackstone, was not one of them. In his mammoth compilation of the criminal law, still annually updated and cited in English courts, he assured readers during the 1760s that judgment by 12 men, quote, indifferently chosen and superior to all suspicion, unquote, was the sacred bulwark of the nation's liberties.
The Attorney General for New York argued to the trial judge that the judge should find as a matter of law that what was printed was seditious, and only submit to the jury the question of whether Zenger had published it. Since Zenger had already admitted he printed the paper, the Attorney General's approach guaranteed a conviction. Hamilton countered that the case should go before the jury to determine whether the words that were printed were seditious, and that the jury should acquit. The judge, Chief Justice James Delancey, served at the pleasure of the governor and was under tremendous pressure to accept the Attorney General's argument that the jury be instructed that the words were in fact seditious. On the other hand, there was some fortitude and independence in this judge, and he instructed the jury that,
as the facts or words and the information are confessed, the only thing that can come before you is whether the words as set forth in the information make a libel, and that is a matter of law, no doubt which you may leave to the court.
At first blush, it appears like the Attorney General won, but sometimes appearances can be deceiving. The Chief Justice used the word may, that is, that the jury may have left it to the court to determine the defendant guilty. But that little word made a huge difference. The jury was not instructed to convict, or otherwise the Chief Justice would have instructed that it is a matter of law, no doubt which you must or shall leave to the court. The jury took the hint, or at the very least the opening, and acquitted Zenger. The idea of the independence and indispensable need for juries was becoming firmly rooted in the rich soil of colonial liberty. Closer in time to the Revolution, in 1763, Thomas Forcey of Virginia owed £150 to a creditor. The creditor sent Waddell Cunningham to try to collect the debt. Forcey was not about to just fork over the money to the debt collector, and a fight erupted, which ended when the debt-collecting Cunningham struck Forcey with a sword and nearly killed him. Fortunately for him, Forcey recovered, and Cunningham was eventually convicted of criminal assault and fined £30. Unsatisfied with the relatively minor criminal fine, Forcey then sued Cunningham in a civil case, seeking £5,000 of damages. Now that was an enormous sum of money in those days. Three judges presided over a jury trial. The jury found Cunningham liable and awarded £1,500. Under the common law, a jury's determination of facts could not be appealed. You could only appeal a mistake of law. But for some reason, the king took an interest in this case and had given instructions to Cunningham that if the damages exceeded a certain amount, he should appeal to the lieutenant governor and the New York council. Since the verdict did indeed exceed this amount, Cunningham followed the king's instructions and demanded that the judges hear the appeal. The judges flatly denied the request, opining that,
we are judges of law and not to be directed by any other instructions.
Unplussed, Cunningham went through a bunch of maneuvers to try to get the lieutenant governor and then authorities in England to overrule the jury award. The controversy was ended when the Attorney General and Solicitor General in England issued a novel joint opinion, affirming that the jury's findings of fact were sacred. The independence and vital importance of the jury had once again been illustrated and fortified. As important as the Zenger and Forcey cases were, a third trial is generally thought to have had a longer-lasting and critical impact on world history. This one launched the career of one of America's most formidable and charismatic leaders, Patrick Henry. Commonly called the Parsons Cause, this case began as a simple collections case. In colonial Virginia, the government had an established church. That is an official government-approved Church of Virginia, and its ministers were paid by taxes. Now, Virginia was still an overwhelmingly agricultural economy, and like many others, the government ordered that the ministers be paid in, of all things, tobacco. Each minister was paid by their vestry, that is, the local church for which they worked, a certain amount of tobacco for their services. This worked great, as the price of tobacco had been steady for decades. But then droughts hit the crops, and harvests were poor. There is an old economic law called supply and demand, and when the amount of tobacco drastically dropped, the price dramatically increased. All of a sudden, the ministers who were used to selling their tobacco for 2 cents per pound were now getting 6 cents per pound. The Virginia House of Burgesses was not excited about the ministers receiving a windfall, so it passed a two-penny act in 1758, which in essence readjusted the payment of the clergy back to the traditional rate. The ministers, on the other hand, felt they were being cheated. They were able to convince English authorities to eliminate the two-penny act. If you're wondering how they could do that, review episode 25. The English also suggested to the clergy that they sue their vestries for lost compensation. Parson James Murray got the message and sued his vestry for the compensation he had lost while the two-penny act was in effect. He easily proved that he was entitled to compensation, and the only issue left for a jury trial was how much he should be paid. That's commonly referred to in the law as damages. Then appeared onto the scene a young Patrick Henry. He became the lawyer for the vestry in the damages part of the case. On the day of the trial, Henry walked to court and saw his uncle, the Reverend Henry, who was going to watch the proceedings. Patrick asked his uncle not to attend. When asked why, Patrick replied,
"I fear that I shall be too much overawed by your presence to be able to do my duty to my clients. Besides, sir, I shall be obliged to say some hard things of the clergy, and I am very unwilling to give pain to your feelings."
The uncle told 27-year-old Patrick that he thought that such a strategy was unwise, but acceded to his nephew's wish and did not attend court. But no matter what the young man's feelings, he couldn't stop his father from attending. Colonel John Henry, after all, was the presiding judge. After the sheriff went down about town and rustled in 12 jurors, Parson Murray complained that they were out of the vulgar herd and were not men of substance or loyal Anglicans. Henry responded that they were all honest men, and they were sworn in at once. He was no fool. Three of them were new lights. That is, they were not members of the Anglican Church and did not believe in much of any organized religion, and one of the jurors was his cousin. It didn't seem like it would matter much. Liability was already admitted. On hand to cheer on Parson Murray were several ministers. Also on hand was a large crowd of colonials, hoping that by some manner of divine intervention, perhaps that Henry would minimize the damages. Opposing counsel straightforwardly argued that but for the two-penny act, Parson Murray should have received £450, but he was only paid £150, so he was entitled to £300. Then he longingly praised the Anglican clergy. Historian A.J. Langeth explained what came next.
When Henry's turn came, he got to his feet slowly, bowed to the bench, and ambled over to the jurors. His first few words came faltering, and after Lyons's assured performance, a lost cause he looked, doomed still further. Townspeople who liked Henry looked away from him, and the parsons on their bench were seen exchanging smiles. One onlooker thought that Judge Henry seemed ready to slide under his seat from shame. Then Patrick Henry underwent a transformation. His mind seemed to turn on and generate heat until he began to glow. His shoulders straightened, and he looked for the first time as though he might be 6 feet tall. His movements had become graceful, even elegant, but when he turned his eyes on the jury, they saw lightning in them. One man swore afterwards that Henry's voice had made his hair stand on end and his blood run cold. Parson Morey was appalled at the beginning of Henry's harangue, which he considered only a barrage of irrelevant precedents aimed at confusing the jury. But then Patrick Henry went beyond all decency. He announced that the king and his people had a binding contract. The king was duty-bound to protect the people and were pledged to obey him. The Twopenny Act of 1758 had been good and valid legislation. When King George II didn't approve it, he had given evidence of misrule. Whenever that happened, a king ceased to be a father of his people and degenerated into a tyrant. At that point, Peter Lyons rose from his chair.
The gentleman has spoken treason, and I am astonished that your worships can hear it without emotion or any mark of dissatisfaction.
From around the room came murmurs of support.
Treason! Treason!
The bench refused to interrupt. One juror nodded vigorously at Henry, who rounded now on the parsons.
This was obviously quite the scene. Nothing like anything I've experienced in my courtroom. Here was the son of the judge condemning the king himself. He then turned his attack on the clergy and berated them as greedy hypocrites who cared nothing for their parishioners except to obtain their money, even at the cost of further burdening those who are suffering grinding poverty. Henry's speech went on for another hour, and he told the jurors they didn't need to award any damages, but if they decided to do so, let it be the minuscule amount of a farthing. Lyons gave a rebuttal. The jury left and came back almost immediately and awarded four times more than Henry suggested, a whole penny. The courtroom went crazy. Supporters grabbed Henry, hoisted him on their shoulders, and carried him out of the courtroom. Patrick Henry's amazing argument and the astonishing verdict had several long-lasting effects. It directly and successfully opposed the king, undermined royal rule, and most importantly, solidified the reputation and legal effect of the independence of juries as a vital hedge against tyranny and as an unalienable right that must be protected. This sentiment had already developed before the parson's cause, but it was certainly undeniable at that point. The year before, an anonymous writer dubbed Britannicus Americanus wrote in the Boston Gazette this striking pronouncement about the vital nature of juries. Of all the rights of Englishmen, those who consent into their own laws and begin tried by juries are the most material and important. Upon the present supposition, the Parliament of England has no more lawful power to make an act which shall deprive the people of New England of those rights than they have to make an act to deprive the people of Old England of the same rights. If these are indefeasible rights of the one, so they must be of the other, they being fellow subjects and standing upon equal footing. The Boston Gazette was echoing a widespread belief. Jurist and legal scholar Sir William Blackstone's Commentaries on the Laws of England was tremendously influential with the founding generation. While describing juries, he tellingly wrote that trial by jury
is adapted and framed for the investigation of truth beyond any other method of trial in the world. The jury system is scrupulously delicate, and how impartially just the law of England approves itself in the constitution and frame of a tribunal, thus excellently contrived for the test and investigation of truth, which appears most remarkably in the avoiding of frauds and secret management by electing the 12 jurors out of the whole panel by lot, and in its caution against all partiality and bias. Upon these accounts, the trial by jury even has been, and I trust ever will be, looked upon as the glory of the English law. It is the most transcendent privilege which any subject can enjoy, or with for that he cannot be affected either in his property, his liberty, or his person, but by the unanimous consent of 12 of his neighbors and equals.
In short, the Founding Fathers understood that juries are indispensable to finding the truth, ensuring justice, protecting liberty, and allowing the people to participate in the government. The right to the jury trial protects the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and property, and embodies the social compact and bolsters limited government. This would even be borne out in favor of the even unpopular occupying English army when a Boston jury acquitted all the soldiers involved in the Boston Massacre from murder charges and acquitted most of them of all charges. John Adams, eventual leader of the movement for independence, represented the soldiers, proving that juries could provide justice and fair verdicts even under enormously grave and volatile circumstances. And of course, the British recognized the vital importance of the right to a jury in the colonies and did nothing to undermine it. Yep, you guessed it. From Heath Ledger's rendition of the Joker, the British once again totally miscalculated during their crackdown on the colonies. As we discussed at length in episode 31, even before the successful conclusion of the French and Indian War, England started to crack down on illegal smuggling between the colonies and the Caribbean. England passed the Sugar Act, also known as the Revenue Act of 1764, which created a new vice admiralty court in Halifax, Canada. Violations of custom laws were triable in this court, but this court had no jury. All the protections and advantages of a trial by jury just vanished. In addition, the accused was presumed guilty, the reverse then in a criminal jury trial. Worse, the judges have an incentive to find the defendants guilty. One of the punishments for being found guilty was the confiscation of the ships and other property involved in smuggling, and the judges were paid out of those proceeds. This was a corrupt system with perverse incentives. If there was a jury, they could see that justice was being done, but without a jury, the temptation for the judges to cast aside the law, facts, and justice was palpable. The Founding Fathers saw this as a grievous violation of justice and unalienable rights. Moreover, the short-lived Stamp Act was also enforceable in any court of record, which included the Admiralty Courts. This was seen as an unprecedented action. The Stamp Act had absolutely nothing to do with trade laws. They had nothing to do with sea routes or transportation. It was a complete affront to the unalienable right of the right to a jury trial. This complaint was vigorously repeated over and over again by the colonists. The Stamp Act was quickly repealed in 1766, but the attempt to suppress the right to the jury left a deep scar in the American psyche. Maybe it could have healed over, but the English reopened the scar in just 2 years. England passed the Vice Admiralty Court Act of 1768. Now, some historians consider this a Townshend Act, and others say no. Prime Minister Lord Charles Townshend had died the year before, but however you label it, the founding generation despised it. It established a new vice admiralty courts in the colonies. Boston, Philadelphia, and Charleston were graced with more juryless courts, also with the same presumption of guilt and incentive for guilty verdicts. Now, I don't want to mislead you. Admiralty courts have been firmly established in England for over a century. But as we've discussed in several episodes, the colonies were left to their own devices in their liberty in the wilderness. In light of the policy of salutary neglect, including the nearly non-existent enforcement of the trade laws, as a practical matter, colonists were hardly ever tried in an admiralty court. Before the 1760s, any such trials would have to have occurred in England, and frankly, there was little interest. Jury trials became the expected and revered method of adjudicated justice in the colonies. The Zenger trial and the Parsons cause reinforced the sentiment. Trials in colonial courts of record would have been before colonial judges and juries. But with the beginning of the Revenue Act of 1764, the rules were changing. Then the Stamp Act. Then the Vice Admiralty Court Act of 1768. The Americans refused to accept this change. When the Stamp Act Congress convened, they passed the following condemnation:
that the trial by jury is the inherent and invaluable right of every British subject in these colonies, that the late Act of Parliament entitled an Act for granting and applying certain stamp duties and other duties in the British colonies and plantations in America, etc., by imposing taxes on the inhabitants of these colonies, and the said Act, and several other acts, by extending the jurisdiction of the courts of admiralty beyond its ancient limits, have a manifest tendency to subvert the rights and liberties of the colonist. This continued to be a serious irritant and a major bone of contention for the colonist. Nearly a decade later, the First Continental Congress's declaration and resolves issued on October 14, 1774, provided as follows. The several acts which impose duties for the purpose of raising a revenue in America extend the powers of the Admiralty Courts beyond their ancient limits, deprive the American subject of trial by jury, authorize the judge's certificate to indemnify the prosecutor from damages that he might otherwise be liable to requiring oppressive security for a claimant of ships in good seas before he shall be allowed to defend his property, and are subversive of American rights. To these grievous acts and measures, Americans cannot submit. And when it was time to fight, the Second Continental Congress issued a declaration of the causes and necessity of taking up arms on July 6, 1775. Again, the Congress highlighted the violation of the right to the jury as part of a long-term conspiracy by the British to crush American liberties. Parliament was influenced to adopt the pernicious project and assuming a new power over them, having the course of 11 years given such decisive specimens of the spirit and consequences attending this power as to leave no doubt concerning the effects of acquiescence under it. They have undertaken to give and grant our money without our consent. Statutes have been passed for extending the jurisdiction of courts of admiralty beyond their ancient limits, for depriving us of the accustomed and inestimable privilege of trial by jury, in such case affecting both life and liberty. And of course, less than a year later, this grievance would reappear in the Declaration of Independence. Mike Gerard, batters up.
Why, thank you, Judge. And now we move on to grievance number 19, which is tightly related to the last grievance, for transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses. And so to be conjoined with the inalienable right of trial by jury is the location of the trial and how the jurors are selected. Now, English law had long held that trials were to be held in the county in which the case arose. And today, we refer to where a case is to be tried as a venue and the area from which the jurors are to be selected as a vicinage. Today, these are one and the same. For example, if a felony is allegedly committed in Oakland County, Michigan, which is where Judge Warren's jurisdiction is, barring extraordinary circumstances, the case would be tried at the courthouse in the seat of the county, which is Pontiac, Michigan, and the jurors would be drawn from across Oakland County. And that ensures that a criminal defendant would be tried by a jury of his peers. Now, this idea was originally set forth in the Magna Carta, in connection with the trial of nobles, and it was eventually expanded to address all crimes. It also ensured that defendants would not be ground down and harassed by requiring that their trials be held in places inconvenient and far away. And it also ensured that witnesses and other evidence would be readily available and that the jurors would be familiar with the circumstances surrounding the purported crime. In addition, this is an embodiment of the first principle of the social compact, that people have a stake in ensuring justice is done in connection with crimes that occur within their local jurisdiction. Now, it also holds the government officials involved to be accountable to the local populace and that the local populace is accountable to the law. But the British tossed away that traditional understanding. And as we just discussed, the original Admiralty Courts were in England, and with the Vice Admiralty Act of 1764, a new Vice Admiralty Court was established in Halifax, Canada. Although in theory, there could be an arduous overland route to Halifax, traveling by sea was the most common and likely pathway to Halifax, and obviously a trial in England required a dangerous oversea passage across the Atlantic. As part of the Intolerable Acts passed in the wake of the Boston Tea Party, England passed the Administration of Justice Act of 1774. This was part of grievance number 15 and addressed at great lengths in a prior episode. And basically, it was that this law ships murder trials in Boston to other colonies or to Britain. And the key here is, although it maintained the right to the jury, it definitely permitted the most gravest of trials, trials for murder, that normally would be tried by a jury of one peers in the colonies, to instead involve a trial after the accused was shipped overseas. Another mostly neglected law was also resurrected by the English Empire, which allowed that another grave crime, this time treason, was to be tried overseas. The Treason Act of 1543, passed during the reign of King Henry VIII, provided that an act of treason or misprision of treason committed outside of England could be tried within England. And by the way, misprision of treason is basically when someone knows that someone else is planning or is committing treason and not turning them in to the authorities. Remember, the realm of England was the imperial seat of the vast British Empire, so treason committed in Ireland, Scotland, the Caribbean islands, or some further outpost of the British Empire would be triable in England, which would likely ensure a more favorable outcome for the Empire. Again, because of salutary neglect and the liberty of the wilderness, this law was never invoked in the American colonies, and it never would be. Still, the colonists were very concerned that it could be. In 1769, the colonists robustly protested the Townshend Acts passed the year before. Parliament considered some of these protests to possibly be treasonous. It instructed Massachusetts Governor Francis Bernard to investigate Bostonians for treason, which, if charged, would be tried in England. Governor Bernard, however, never found enough evidence to charge anyone, so the issue was rendered moot. Nevertheless, the issue rose its ugly head again in 1772, and in that year, the colonists assaulted and burned to ruin the Gaspee, which was a British patrol ship tasked with halting smugglers. Historian Dr. Herbert Friedenwald explains what happened next.
After the revenue vessel Gaspee was burned to the water's edge in Narragansett Bay, the determination to punish violators of the Revenue Acts, and these destructive rioters in particular, was greatly intensified. A commission was therefore instituted late in 1772 to investigate this offense. These commissioners had extensive powers, yet the weightiest part of their instructions was that which ordered them to transport the offenders to England for trial. In the autumn of 1772, just previous to the appointment of this commission, and before the knowledge of the Gaspee incident had even reached England, an act had been passed for the better securing and preserving His Majesty's dockyards, magazines, ships, ammunition, and stores, which included the detested transportation provision. It aroused great opposition, for it deprived the colonists of their dearly cherished right of a constitutional trial by a jury of the vicinage.
In addition, one of the intolerable acts adopted in the wake of the Boston Tea Party was the Administration of Justice Act, and it removed the trying of certain cases from Massachusetts to England. The colonists understood what these actions were all about, making sure that colonists were uprooted from their communities and to be shipped overseas for show trials before authorities that would be sympathetic with the Empire's crackdown. The Virginia House of Burgesses initially condemned English attempts to undermine the venue and vicinage in a set of resolves adopted in 1769. These were drafted by George Mason, a leading founding father in Virginia who later was instrumental in ensuring that a Bill of Rights was adopted.
Resolved that all trials for treason, misprision of treason, or for any felony or crime whatsoever committed and done in His Majesty said colony and dominion by any person or persons residing in this colony suspected of any crime whatsoever committed therein and sending such person or persons to places beyond the sea to be tried is highly derogatory of the rights of British subjects, as thereby the inestimable privilege of being tried by a jury from the vicinage, as well as the liberty of summoning and producing witnesses on such trial, will be taken away from the party accused.
Again, in its Declaration and Resolves of 1774, the First Continental Congress condemned this attack as a violation of the rights of Englishmen. The First Continental Congress also elaborated about the vital importance of the jury, including the importance of being tried in the venue and with the jurors locally drawn from the same. And they did this in their appeal to the inhabitants of Quebec on October 26, 1774, and it was primarily drafted by John Dickinson.
The next great right is that of the trial by jury. This provides that neither life, liberty, nor property can be taken from the possessor until 12 of his unexceptionable countrymen and peers of his vicinage, who from that neighborhood may reasonably be supposed to be acquainted with his character and the characters of the witnesses, upon a fair trial and full inquiry, face to face in open court, before as many people as choose to attend, shall pass their sentence upon oath against him. A sentence that cannot injure him without burying their own reputation, and probably their interest also, as the question may turn on points that in some degree concern the general welfare, and if it does not, their verdict may form a precedent that on a similar trial of their own may militate against themselves.
Likewise, Thomas Jefferson condemned this practice in his momentous summary view of the rights of British America, and this was in connection with the Administration of Justice Act, as well as the 1772 Act for the better securing of His Majesty's dockyards, magazines, ships, ammunition, and stores. He illustrated some more of the practical ill effects. And the wretched criminal, if he happened to have offended on the American side, stripped of his privilege of trial by peers of his vicinage, removed from the place where alone full evidence could be obtained, without money, without counsel, without friends, without exculpatory proof, is tried before judges predetermined to condemn. The coward who would suffer a countryman to be torn from the bowels of their society in order to be thus offered a sacrifice to parliamentary tyranny would merit that everlasting infamy now fixed on the authors of the act. And so, the British assaulted due process and justice by not only depriving colonists of the right to the jury, but shipping them overseas for the trial, uprooting them from their community and crippling their ability to achieve a fair trial. There's one caveat to this 19th grievance. Obviously, the British were dead set on depriving the colonists of their basic rights, but they never had the opportunity to enforce it. Historians haven't been able to identify any persons actually shipped over to England, but it was the law of the land. The failure of the prosecution is almost certainly due to the fact that the American authorities weren't about to allow any of their colonists to be seized and shipped overseas for trial. After all, they wouldn't even allow tax tea to reach a dock to be unloaded. The 20th grievance proceeds to an entirely different topic, and in fact, out of the colonies altogether. For abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government, and enlarging its boundaries, so as to render it once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule in these colonies. Now this grievance is all about Canada. When the British Empire defeated the French Empire in the Seven Years' War, the French were forced to cede to the British their territory in Canada. Now, there had been some serious fighting in Canada, and the British were pleased to force the French out. But This was very tricky. The colonial inhabitants of Canada were mostly French in origin. They had a very different culture and expectations for the good life. For example, since King Henry VIII had cut ties to Rome and declared himself the head of the Church of England, the British were decidedly Protestant. I mean, that's not to say that there weren't Catholics or other religious dissenters in the empire, and that's really quite to the contrary. In fact, for a short period, Queen Mary, who was a Catholic, turned the tables against the Protestants. But to make an exceedingly complicated and very long story simple and short, there were many persecutions and executions during religious infighting among the followers of Christ, which is quite ironic, of course. But by the 1760s, Protestantism dominated the English government and culture, and then, all of a sudden, they took control of firmly Catholic Canada. Now, the British weren't particularly interested in persecuting the Canadians, and the Canadians weren't particularly opposed to English rule if they could maintain their way of life. I mean, Catholics outnumbered Protestants in Canada 400-1. Since the end of the French and Indian War, the province had been under military rule. The Catholic threat to the English monarchy had long been defeated, so now the goal was just to keep the subjects of the empire loyal. Britain had implemented a policy of reconciliation with the Catholic Irish and the Catholic Scots in the Scottish Highlands. The British didn't want an uprising in French-dominated Canada, and they needed their loyalty. So in the end, to ingratiate the empire to the Canadians, it enacted the Quebec Act of 1774. The Quebec Act had a number of provisions. First, it surprisingly expanded the Canadian colony. The southern border dropped south to the Ohio River, and its western boundary was expanded to the Mississippi River. Second, this geographic expansion swept in another 80,000 French settlers into the colony. Third, the practice of Catholicism was protected so long as the priests recognized King George III as their sovereign. Fourth, it ended British military rule and created a civilian centralized government. Fifth, it preserved the French civil code, which wiped out English common law and meant there would be no civil trials by jury. Sixth, although there was civilian control, there was no elected legislative assembly. The king's appointed governor and his council would rule the province without check. And no representative government there. And seventh, Catholics could serve as government officials. And finally, eighth, a Catholic bishop had settled in Canada. And so the Quebec Act was viewed with deep suspicion and alarm. Now, had it simply occurred as a standalone act, that it would have provoked such a reaction is doubtful, but its timing was as bad as one could choose, and many viewed it as a foreshadowing of what might happen in the 13 colonies. It had a number of ill effects on the eyes of the original British colonists. Geographically, it cut off claims of the colonies to the west. Now, as we covered in a prior episode, some of the colonies claimed lands far to the west. They simply argued that their western borders reached to the western end of the continent. Many colonists felt that they had won the French and Indian War and would be entitled to settle the western frontier. Now, England has betrayed them by giving it to, of all people, the French, the very people the colonists had just defeated in the war. Moreover, many considered the Catholic-dominated people as a threat. Some founding fathers were clearly religious bigots and hated Catholics, or at least didn't want Catholicism to grow in the colonies. "Popery is established," declared Minister Ebenezer Baldwin, and many feared that the king would sell out the colonists with the growth, if not outright take over their colonies with Catholic rule. In fact, some saw the Quebec Act as part of a diabolical plot. Historian Ruth Block concluded that,
"By the 1760s, Both the conflicts of the Great Awakening and the anti-Catholic crusade of the French and Indian War had reinforced the inclination of American Calvinists to see themselves engaged in a cosmic battle with Satan. The symbolic link forging the connection between Great Britain and the Antichrist was typically the pollution of Roman Catholicism. In Boston and elsewhere, traditional anti-Catholic Pope Day celebrations became occasions for dramatizing the patriot cause.
For those of you who grew up in, or at least have studied the Cold War, there was an old theory called encirclement. The idea was that the Soviet Union was militarist and armed to the teeth because it was concerned that it was being encircled by hostile Western capitalist powers. Frankly, I don't think it holds water, but it's an interesting historical parallel for the colonists. Listen to British historian Brendan Sims' take on it.
All lands between the Ohio and Mississippi was now incorporated into Quebec. In the eyes of many North Americans, this threatened the encirclement of the 13 colonies by an absolutist government, a resurrected New France. It restored the pre-1762 threat. If the act were allowed to stand, the 13 colonies would be pinned into a geopolitical reservation from which they could not escape.
The colonists would be trapped beyond all help.
You know, I thought he was going to get away with this episode without the Beatles, but nearly at the last minute, he snatches defeat from the jaws of victory. We got him!
Oh, poor Mike Gerard. He just couldn't help it.
Oh, guys, come on, for the love of... Another simplistic load of drivel. Anyways, many of the colonists, rightly or wrongly, concluded that the Quebec Act was yet more proof of a grand conspiracy by the English Empire to oppress them. Historian Esmond Wright fleshes this out by first noting that although it wasn't part of the Intolerable Act's reaction to the Boston Tea Party, the colonists had the exact opposite impression. Likewise, although it wasn't designed to oppress the colonists again had precisely the opposite understanding.
Of these Intolerable Act measures, the Quebec Act was thought to be part. It had actually been designed before the news of the Boston Tea Party reached London. To the colonists, however, it was particularly alarming because it settled the Northwest land question with a vengeance by transferring the Ohio and Mississippi, in which Virginia, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, and Massachusetts had interest, and it gave to it, even more ominously as Boston saw it, French civil law and Roman Catholic religion. The regime provided was centralized in keeping with the customs of the province. There was to be no trial by jury, and all but purely local taxation was reserved to the British Parliament. Members of the Parliament, Earl of Chatham and Edmund Burke, Charles James Fox and Isaac Barr attacked it vehemently, and their bitterness confirmed colonial suspicions. Although an honest and tolerant measure, drafts of which had been prepared as far back as 1763, it was singularly ill-timed and appeared completely out of line with American constitutional development. The colonists were now to sniff the approach not only of tyranny, but of popery and prelacy in every tainted political breeze. There were affairs, in Chatham's phrase, of popery and arbitrary power. Fears, too, of a popish army being called in to reinforce British General Gage, commander of the British occupying force in Boston, and of French and Indian raiders appearing in the frontier towns.
By abolishing English common law and having a civilian government without a representative assembly, the Quebec Act created an arbitrary government without the protections afforded by free English common law and dominated by a foreign religion accountable to the Pope in Rome. The act cut off additional westward land expansion. The colonists were really being hemmed in. I mean, encirclement wasn't so far off as it might seem to us today. Again, if the Quebec Act had been passed in isolation, it might have raised some eyebrows and perhaps some considerable consternation, but it wouldn't have, by any stretch of the imagination, sparked the American Revolution. But this was just one more grievance, number 20, of a long list of grievances. England just kept compounding its oppressive policies, inadvertently strengthening the case for independence. The British were just adding to the long train of abuses and usurpations, even if unintentionally. The colonists looked at what was happening in Canada and reasonably forecast that key violations of the English Constitution could come for them next. And on that note, back to you, Judge Warren.
Some key takeaways from this episode. The Declaration of Independence is not just a declaration of principles and lofty sentiment, but it lists a specific set of grievances by which the British Empire had violated the first principles of free and just government. The 18th grievance addresses how, by depriving the right to a jury trial in many important kinds of cases, the British Empire subverted unalienable rights, the rule of law, the social compact, and blew up the idea of a limited government. The 19th grievance explains that by preparing to ship criminal defendants overseas for trial, that Great Britain violated the traditional right to be tried by a jury of your peers from the location in which the crime occurred, thereby again infringing unalienable rights, the rule of law, the social compact, and the idea of a limited government. The 20th grievance reveals how the Quebec Act cut off westward expansion, abolished English common law in Canada, created a civilian government that was arbitrary and unaccountable to the people, and fed fears of the colonists that what was happening in Canada would happen to them next. These grievances confirm that the revolution was fought to defend liberty and the first principles of free and just government, not for money. Please join us for our next general episode when we continue our exploration of the grievances of the Declaration of Independence, in particular the 21st and 22nd, which are the following. Quote, "For taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our governments, for suspending our own legislatures and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever," unquote. This podcast is produced by Patriot Week. Please visit Patriot Week's website at patriotweek.org for many fabulous resources, including our new daily video series, Save Our Republic. I am Oakland County Circuit Court Judge Michael Warren and author of America's Survival Guide. Our other two terrific Patriot narrators are Mike Gerard Skonechny, who edits this podcast and is the host of his own unique podcast, Be Reasonable with Mike Gerard, and bombastic Brent Bassett, IT guru and fabulous dungeon master. Our fellow Patriots, thank you for listening.
And don't forget about the Patrick Henry Awards via Zoom on March 23rd, 2021. Visit patriotweek.org for more details. Until next time, God bless you and God bless America. Thank you, our fellow patriots, for listening. Please subscribe to our podcast and rate us. That is, if you're going to give us those 5 golden stars. We can be found on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and many other platforms. You can also find much more at patriotweek.org, which includes videos, lesson plans, TV episodes, and many other goodies. Patriot Week is celebrated every year from September 11th the anniversary of the terrorist attacks, through September 17th, the anniversary of the signing of the Constitution. It has been recognized by the U.S. Senate and many states. Patriot Week was started by then 10-year-old Leah Warren when she pounded on the table and demanded a new celebration of America. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and on Instagram, or reach out directly at mwarren@patriotweek.org. Also consider Judge Warren's book, America's Survival Guide, How to Stop America's Impending Suicide by Reclaiming Our First Principles and History, by visiting americasurvivalguide.com, Amazon, or any other online retailer. Until next time, God bless you and God bless America.